Welcome to the Central Assembly Podcast. It's our prayer that this message is an encouragement and blessing to your life.
Man, it is so good to be with you guys tonight. I bring greetings from across the street. That's usually where I'm at on Wednesdays. I'm telling you, we have a wonderful time. God is doing some incredible things in and through our students. We've got a great team. Pastor Steve is incredible, wonderful communicator, team leader, and just building teams, bringing teams together. We got such a great staff of volunteers, college students, some of you who come over and minister. I mean, we take you young and old. I mean, it does not matter if you're, you know, gray-haired, retired. We'd love to see you. If you're young and you don't even have kids, college students, we'd love for you to volunteer and partner with us. But we love partnering with parents to make disciples. And I know I've heard some people talk. They're a little worried and concerned about, you know, the generation and where things are heading. And the more I'm over there and I get to know our students, I know God has a bright future in store for the church. I'm not worried at all. I'm not fretting. God is doing an incredible work in and through their lives. And thank you for praying, number one. Thank you, guys. We feel it over there. God's moving in our services, in our classes, in our small groups, in our times together. And we just experience his presence in a real powerful way. So thank you for those of you who pray for our students. Thank you for loving them. You know, sometimes kids, you know, they're kids and teens are teens. And you're very patient with them and loving them. Thank you so much for doing that, being gracious in that way. And we appreciate your love, your prayer, and support. We do. We feel valued as a youth ministry, as a youth group, as part of this church. And so thank you for all that you do. We really, really appreciate it. So ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you know this or not, but this is a football. It was 1961, and the Green Bay Packers had come off a really difficult defeat the season before. They were in the fourth quarter in the lead against, I believe it was the Philadelphia Eagles, and they blew it in the fourth quarter. And I mean, that loss just gnawed at them all season long. The players, you know, I mean, they just were itching to get back in the locker room, to get back on the field, to start training camp, and just see what things that coach could think up, what new strategies, what new things he could do to get them back to that championship game and hopefully win this time. And Vince Lombardi walked into that locker room in July, and he stared at those professional athletes, and with a football in his hand, he said, "Gentlemen, this is a football." And from that training camp and all throughout the season, Vince Lombardi drilled into his team the fundamental of footballs. He told those guys that what every other team takes for granted and just glosses over, we are going to perfect week in and week out. And that season, they dominated in the NFL, and they made it to the championship game and beat the New York Giants 37-0. All because they focused on fundamentals. So we're going to get back to that here in just a little bit. But our youth, our young people in this generation, as you guys know, they're experiencing pressures and just, it's almost insurmountable at times, things that come against them. We feel it, we sense it, we see it within them. And I would even say that this generation, they're probably the least supported generation, both societally and even maybe within the family. I mean, they say our teens now, our kids spend more time with parents than ever before, but the relationship looks different than it used to. And although there may be time proximity-wise, sometimes there's not time, maybe value in what we would think. And so when we look at where our kids are at today, there's really three things that are coming against them. And the first that I just want to throw out there, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I want to get to some solutions things and things that you can do, that we can do as a church to come around them, support them, and encourage them while understanding what it is that they're experiencing and going through. Because what we're talking about tonight is keeping your head while they're losing theirs. And as we're going to see developmentally tonight, that they literally lose their head for a period of time in their lives. But our teens are experiencing some really hardships. And I just want to cover three of them because I don't want to focus on the problem too long, because a problem well-defined is only half solved. And we know we could spend all night talking about the problems, but we know right now that culture is toxic for our teens. It's toxic for families. In fact, if the American Psychological Association in 2012, they came out with a 328-page paper titled "The Immigrant Paradox in Children and Adolescents: Is Becoming American a Developmental Risk?" And see, what it is, for the longest time, the APA had always encouraged immigrant families, starting in the 40s on through the 50s and on, they would always encourage immigrant families to adapt and acclimate to American culture as quickly as possible, to be mentally healthy and functioning in society. But in 2012, they actually reversed their findings, and they declared a resounding, overwhelming yes, that becoming an American is actually a developmental risk. And their recommendation to immigrant families is that they should attempt to hold on to their native language and culture while shielding their children from contemporary American culture as best they can. So actually being foreign rather than being American provided protection against American culture. And I would just throw this out as a little rabbit trail here, that's what the church does as disciples and followers of Christ. We don't walk lock and step with culture. We seek to be countercultural and not always adapt and fall step in line with what culture is doing and saying. And so what we do here as a church, what you do as a Christian family, impacts your kids and in their very formative years. And so the Commission on Children, they go on to say, for children of immigrants and for U.S. children overall, some of the basic foundations of childhood appear currently to be at best anemic, in the sense of being weak and inadequate to foster full human flourishing, and at worst toxic, inadvertently depressing health and engendering emotional distress and mental illness. And so, as we can see, culture is toxic to teens, it's toxic to our families, but it's where we live, it's where we are at. Another thing that we see for students is social connections and technology has changed. You know, back in the day when kids would go to kindergarten, parents could rely and trust that their, you know, the primary focus was going to be on teaching kids, you know, socially how to engage, how to share, how to play, how to get along. But about 20 years ago, and we as educators, we thought we had a brilliant idea. And you know what? We were going to make kindergarten more academically rigorous. You know, gone are the days of teaching kids how to play and to share and get along and, how to share five balls when you're out on the field and there's 20 kids, you know, that want to play. All of those things went by the wayside as we wanted to focus on making kindergarten and those primary years of learning academically rigorous. And what we're seeing in education now is that increasingly kids are coming to us with fewer and fewer social skills, coming to us with fewer and fewer coping skills when they're experiencing stress and anxiety in their lives. And so unfortunately, families aren't supported in ways that they historically have been supported, even by the educational institutions. We also see, with the rise of technology and social connections, the modern phenomenon of cyberbullying. Now, how many, you know, was bullied, you know, went to school, you know, you dodged that kid in the bathroom, in the halls, in the locker room. I mean, you didn't want to encounter them because you knew what was going to happen. I experienced it. I know probably many of you did. And bullying was a tough thing, but the cyber form of bullying, it is so different how our kids experience it psychologically. Relationally, you know, when things happened with me at the school, you know, let's say somebody said something mean to me repeatedly at my locker, you know, that event was basically contained to maybe the 10 or 15 people just around that area that were in proximity to it. But nowadays, when kids are cyberbullied online and kids take pictures of them, post on their profiles and begin to say mean and hurtful things, Our students feel as if the whole world is in on it with them, that the whole world is against them, that the whole world thinks this about them. And it is such a depressing and tough thing. Our kids it's just the reality of where our world is. Kids are connected socially in that way, and they're going to be. But with that comes those areas and forms of cyberbullying that they're dealing with that no other generation has dealt with before. Another thing that we see changing is the self-esteem culture, the kind of the crisis that we're in. You know, again, about 20 years ago or so, we thought that, you know, we wanted kids to feel good about themselves. So if we just said it to them enough, if we just handed them enough trophies and enough ribbons, that they would and along just believe what we're saying about them. But what happens is we've actually, when we do that, we've shortchanged a biological process that takes place in kids. The only way of building literal, actually healthy self-esteem or self-confidence, as we would call it, is you have to accomplish something. You have to endure, you have to persevere, you have to work through and accomplish that, the effect of, you know, of what you're doing. Accomplish the task. Because what happens is when you work hard and you accomplish a task, your brain actually gives you a dopamine rush, which reinforces that behavior of working hard and accomplishing something. But what we've done is we've kind of pulled that from under our rugs and shortchanged our kids. And in doing so, it's done one of two things. It's either left those affirmations feeling empty and hollow, and it doesn't resound with their souls and their spirits, or it's led them to feeling entitled that they deserve it and it should just be handed to them without doing anything. And so as we've seen, I mean, we could spend all night here talking about the changes, but these are some major shifts that are taking place and have taken place in our culture that our young people are going through. Another one is just parent changes and pressures that parents are under. You know, there used to be a cultural consensus, right or wrong, but of how you raise kids, of what you're supposed to do. There was never a question in a parent's mind of when your kid stepped out of line or did something wrong that you didn't do this. There never was a question. But nowadays, parents are constantly second-guessing themselves. Media, I mean, there's experts, they hear expert voices all the time of what to do, what not to do. And honestly, sometimes the expert voices can be contradictory to one another. And so it leaves parents kind of in this state of shell shock, wondering, man, what do I do? And we live in constant fear of messing our kids up, or we parent out of a place of fear because we don't want to mess them up. We don't want to break them. We don't want something, you know, bad to happen to them. And then as parents, we honestly, I mean, if self-reflect a little bit, if we're honest, we probably never feel like we're doing a good enough job. I mean, we're our toughest critics. I mean, we spend time with our kids, we invest, but at the end of the day, when we lay our head down on our pillow at night, oftentimes we feel like, man, I messed up here. I could have done better there. And we just beat ourselves up. And it takes this emotional stress and mental strain on ourselves. And so parents are dealing with this, just this lack of consensus of how to go about raising kids. Dr. Leonard Sachs, he goes on to say that kids are being deprived today of emotionally available parents. Parents are working hard, trying to provide for their family, and there's just not as much of themselves emotionally to be available. Kids are experiencing the lack of clearly defined limits and guidance. Adults, there is no authority in their lives. They kind of get to decide and do what they want to do, and that creates stress and anxiety in children. Kids are lacking responsibilities, balanced nutrition, adequate sleep, movement outdoors, creative play, social interaction, opportunities of unstructured boredom. You've heard that within teens. I'm bored. I don't want to do, you know. It happens. And that's where we're at as a culture. That's where we're at as a society. But so what we're wanting to head here, though, is what's going on with kids. I want you to know it is not outside of the sovereign hand and ordination of God. God has he's overseeing, and he has his hand in everything that's going on with our kids. And if we would, we're going to look at Psalm 139. And I love how David starts out there, because at first he starts out the psalm and he's talking about how God knows him. How God knows him. He says, you know, you've searched me, Lord, and you know me. And he talks about all these ways that God knows him and sees him. And then he says that you're with me, that you hem me in behind and before, you lay your hand upon me. Then he goes on later on to say that God, you made me. And David begins to talk about how God's hand was in the developmental process. Even before he was born, he says in Psalm 139, 14, he says, I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. David's describing here that God ordained and oversees every stage of human development. And when we read this verse, we often celebrate it in those years when our children are born and they're little and they're learning to walk and talk. And it's so cute. It's wonderful. You know, they're making all these sorts of sounds. They're spitting everywhere. I mean, but we love it. I mean, because we see the growth. We see the change. We see the development. And we just feel this romantic notion that God's hand is in it, you know, and he's with our kids and with us as parents. And we just love it. Those first, you know, year or two of life. But if we're going to be theologically honest, we've got to say that God's hand is also in the developmental process as our kids become teens, as they're developing and becoming young men and women, young adults. His hand is in that as well. His hand is in that even when there's raging hormones, there are those volatile emotions, when there's pimples and periods and all this stuff happening within them, when their hormones are out of whack, God's hand is in it, and he is leading and guiding the process as well. So I want you to turn to your neighbor tonight, and I want you to say, his works are wonderful. Say it to your neighbor tonight, his works are wonderful. Not just when they're little babies, but even as they're becoming teens and they're growing. And so as they become teens and they begin to go through adolescence, they experience life in extremes. Honestly, if you've got teens, know teens, relate with teens, you know oftentimes there's very little middle ground with them. They are either up here or they're down here. I mean, that's how they experience life and the extremes. And it's really due to the natural process of what's going on in their brains during adolescence. This actually starts roughly about the age of 12, and it goes all the way to 22, maybe 24, even 25, and some of us young men. It takes us a while, okay? So their brains are actually continuing to grow and develop during this time of their lives. And they're working on forming their values. They're deciding who they want to be, what they want to be. They're internalizing their faith. Oftentimes, they've got questions. They've got doubts. It's natural. It's okay. That's the only way their faith ever becomes their own. And so it is actually a time of life that I hope tonight that we can walk away. It's not one to be feared, but it's one to be celebrated and enjoyed and experienced. Is there stress? You remember what it was like, sleepless nights as young parents? I mean, it's tough, okay? It's just par for the course. There are some things that come with adolescence and their lives, but it's a wonderful time in their lives. And so I'm going to just kind of walk you through the brain and some of the changes that our kids go through as they become teens, as they're going through adolescence, and how that developmentally impacts them and how we see that and what are some things that we can do then in connecting with them and relating with them. Because even if you don't have a teen in your home, you know teens, right? Everybody in here knows teens. You relate to teens. You interact with teens. You got grandkids. You got nieces and nephews. I mean, all of us in here know teens. And so hopefully this is helpful information. So the first part of the brain I want to focus on is that brain stem. So I want you, everybody, hold up your right hand. And I want you to imagine this is your spinal column right here, okay? And when you get right here to the base of your wrist and your hand there, that is about where the brain stem is located at. And the brain stem, I mean, it's what takes care of all of our automatic functions. I mean, nobody is in here, you know, having to say, breathe. You know, breathe, it just happens, or blink, you know. I mean, we do this automatically. It's also where, when we're in danger and we're frightened and afraid, it's where our response, a fight, flight, or freeze happens at. And it's automatic responses. And all of us in here, we do one of three things when we get scared or we feel like we're in danger: fight, flight, or freeze. That takes place here at the brainstem, okay? Now I want you to open your hand, and I want you to wrap your thumb into the middle part of your palm there, okay? And this is the limbic system. It's the emotional part of the brain, the emotional center of the brain. And I mean, this is a fun place of the brain. I mean, this is the part of the brain that's responsible for creativity and fun and excitement and enjoyment. I mean, all these things taken here, spontaneity. I mean, this is kind of the party center of the brain, the fun part of the brain, the emotional center, where our memories are stored at. All life experiences flow through here, and depending on what emotion is connected to that memory, it depends on where it's stored in our brain. It's really exciting, you know, the emotional center of the brain. Now I want you to wrap your four fingers now over your thumb, and this is what we call the prefrontal cortex, that prefrontal lobe, that front part of your brain. Now, this is the big boy, big girl brain. This is the adult brain, okay? This is the part of the brain that all the higher executive functions that take place in our body happens here. The complex functions like reasoning, problem solving, judgment, impulse control, okay? All that stuff happens in the prefrontal cortex. But now what happens as kids go into adolescence, it's almost as if a demolition job begins to take place in the prefrontal cortex, and it begins to build itself into the adult brain. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever lived in a home that's being remodeled, but it's a mess, right? It's, you know, you remodel the bathroom or the kitchen, and it's just messy. And it's not like you can't ever go into that room or do anything in that room, but it's just a mess. So oftentimes you kind of move things out, right? You kind of move things in a different way. You move into another room. And so what happens when kids begin to go through those teenage years, the seat of operations actually moves from the prefrontal cortex, and they move into the emotional center of their brain. Hence, living life in extremes. They feel so emotional. They are emotional all the time. So if you think about your brain having two stories, this is the lower story, this is the upper story. Sometimes teens need help getting up here, okay? They need help getting there. Moms and dads, adults, parents, they need our help to get there. So that renovation is taking place. And because it is, they don't always quickly have access to the prefrontal cortex, okay? And so as we talk about that, you can understand and see why teens do some pretty stupid stuff sometimes. I mean, they just do. They lack that area of the brain. I mean, sometimes they don't have access to it. So they're not thinking rationally. They're not planning well for the future. They're not evaluating the consequences of their choices. They just aren't. That's where they're at. Sometimes they just do the best that they can with the brain they have. The last few years, I had the privilege of my counseling colleague at Pipkin was Linda Cox. She had actually was a counselor at Weller Elementary 5 years prior to coming to Pipkin, and we worked together for 3 years there. But what was so interesting, and we talked often about this, is that she would teach kids. She would go into the classrooms and teach the guidance curriculum, teach things about socially solving problems and all these things to the students. And then she came to Pipkin, and some of the kids that she had taught in elementary, she began to see there at Pipkin. But what happened is the kids would come over there, she would be like, what in the world has happened to them? I mean, we talked about this in elementary. We talked about iMessage and how to solve conflicts and all this. And it was like they came over there and they had lost their minds. And it's like they had forgotten everything that they had learned and taught. And, you know, sometimes parents experience this at church. You know, your kids go to Central Kids and everything's going smooth and then they're nice and sweet. And all of a sudden they start walking across the street and you're like, who is this kid? You guys are doing something to them over there. And it's not necessarily youth or anything. It's where our kids are at developmentally at that time in their lives and what the things that they're going through. And so as parents, as adults, we often are looking for, and we want to know, well, what's the magic bullet? You know, what is that thing that I need to find? Parents are wanting to know. They're looking for it. They're trying to find it. And what I want to say tonight is just dispel the myth, there is no magic bullet. There isn't. There is no thing that you're going to find, okay? This is a football, okay? It goes back to the fundamentals. It goes back to the basics. What our kids need more than anything are meaningful relationships. That's fundamental. Kids and teens, as human beings, we are biologically hardwired for connection and relationships. And so, I don't want to discourage you, but there's no magic bullet out there. You know, it's kind of like if you've got kids or grandkids, you've probably watched the movie Kung Fu Panda, right? Where Po opens the dragon scroll and there's nothing there but his reflection. And he goes back and he talks to his dad and he's all disappointed and he finds out that there's no secret ingredient in the secret sauce. And he comes to realize that the whole time, it's him. And I would say that, I would speak that over you tonight as adults, as parents. There's no magic bullet. There is no secret sauce. There is no dragon scroll. It's just you. And the power of presence and relationship that you bring to your kids, that you bring to your community, that you bring to your neighborhood, that you bring to wherever kids and teens are at, you bring that to them. They need meaningful relationships with parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, okay? They need meaningful relationships with their neighbors, members of the community, teachers at school, people here at church. Our teens need these things. They're hardwired for enduring attachments, moral and spiritual meaning. And to be honest, this is oftentimes what is lacking for most kids in culture. So many of the kids that I see and interact with at Pipkin on a daily basis, man, they have not got a fraction of what my two kids have gotten in home growing up. And we see the effects of it. We see it in society. The YMCA partnered with a global strategy group, and they surveyed thousands of teens and parents all across the country. And they wanted to know what was the most concerning things for teens and parents. And it was really surprising what they found out. As they surveyed all these parents, you know, there's some hypotheses of what they might find, you know, what their friends think of them, you know, some of the pressures that they're experiencing. But when the results came back, the number one concern that teens had was spending quality time with their family. And that blew them away. In fact, parents, their top concern, time with family, time with their kids, wasn't even in the top three. It was number four. And the top concerns were things like outside worries and concerns, like kids getting involved in drugs and alcohol, premarital sex, all those kinds of things that parents didn't want their kids getting involved in. Time together was what concerned their teens the most. And so the thing, when we think about that, the thing that kids need most is actually the preventative measure that you may have been looking for, and that's time with you. Meaningful connections and relationships with adults in their lives. But what research shows is as kids grow and they become teenagers, they actually begin to spend less time with their parents. And I get this because I've got a preteen in my house, and I know what it's like. Your kids get older, and it's like, oh my word, we can actually leave the house together and maybe run to the grocery store together or go get coffee. I mean, it becomes fun. It's just natural. It's where we're at. I've experienced, but as they become teens, they actually begin to spend less time with their parents. They say kids on average spend about 57 minutes with mom and dad combined a day. As they become teens, that number drops to about 20 minutes combined with mom and dad per day. So at a time in their lives where teens actually need their parents the most, they're getting 2/3 less time with their parents than they did when they were kids. And I would propose that our teens need us now more than ever before. They probably need parents more when they're 13, 14, and 15 than when they were 8, 9, and 10. Just because, again, you lose half your mind, what's going to happen? And so it looks different than when they're kids, but they need us. They need that relationship with us. And so what I want to do is just throw out some quick things. as you communicate, as a parent, as a grandparent, as a person who interacts with teens, just here's some pointers. I know everybody's looking at the clock. I know I'm going long. Thank you for being patient. But I just want to throw out some things to you tonight that we can do as we connect with teens, how we can understand how their brain impacts relationship and communication. And the first one is that we got to recognize that kids are thinking emotionally. They're not thinking logically. Remember where they're at. They're living in the emotional center of the brain. And because of that, they're not thinking logically. You know, I mean, you ever said to your teen, you know, they stay up all night playing Fortnite before a final, and they, you know, they wake up the next morning, they're tired. Why are you so tired? Well, I stayed up like playing video games. You're like, what were you thinking? They weren't. They don't. Very often, they don't think. They need us helping them walk upstairs. They need help with that. Another thing that we can do as we connect with teens is the principle of mirroring. And so oftentimes what we know in relationships, there's a profound biological principle that we fear what is different from us and we are drawn to what is similar. And so mirroring is something that we can do as adults and parents in connecting with teenagers. And it's that art of insinuating similarity. It's building trust. And so it's things like, it's basically repeating the last three words they say or three critical words that they may say and just repeating it back to them. So you and your teen, you're having an argument about something they want to do and, you know, they're frustrated and they just, you know, they say, you just don't understand. Yeah, I don't understand. Just leave it hanging out there. Yeah, you just don't trust me. I don't trust you. I'm serious. Try that. Mirror what they say and repeat that back to them. It's a way of building familiarity and connection. There was actually a psychologist that did a study, Richard Wiseman. He created this study using waiters and waitresses. So what he did is he had a group that would just practice positive affirmation. You know, when somebody would place an order, they would say things like, oh, that's such a great choice, or good job, or nice, oh, that's going to be really good. You know, positive affirmation. And then there was another group that just practiced mirroring. And what they did is they just repeated the order back to the patrons. And what they found was that those that practiced mirroring rather than positive affirmation actually received 70% more in tips than those that did the affirmation. It's mirroring. It's I begin to see myself in you. I begin to trust you. I begin to open up and relate to you. Another one that we know teens need at this phase is patience and grace. Okay, teens are moody. They're emotional. And when they get moody, sometimes they respond with that attitude and that eye rolling because they're in the emotional part of their brain. And, you know, we want to come at them full force, you know. Man, just they need patience and grace. They do not have the vocabulary to even describe what's going on inside of them. They feel so insecure, so uncertain, and they need patience and grace from us. Another one is practice tactical empathy. Label the emotion, okay? When they're frustrated and upset, just try and label what it is you think they might be feeling and experiencing. It's okay if you don't get it right, because you can say things like, you know, it seems like, or it looks like, or it appears, you're really upset right now. And if you get it wrong and they say, well, that's not what I'm feeling, it's no big deal. You can say, I didn't say that you were. It just seems like, it looks like. That tactical empathy. What they found in brain mapping is that they would show people pictures of emotional faces, and they would measure the response within the persons being studied. And you know, oftentimes it flowed through that emotional part of the brain. But as they asked the person to label the emotion, just state what it is, anger, frustration, sadness, fury, whatever it was, they found that it activated a different part of their brain, a logical part of their brain, and it actually helped to decrease the emotional intensity. So when we label the emotion, it seems like you're really frustrated right now. It seems like you just need a minute to just kind of relax and calm. Doing those things helps us connect with them. Also, at this time, thinking the best and not the worst. This is what we often do. Often, we think we are master psychologists, and we know why everybody is doing what they're doing. And when we do that, we actually ascribe people's motivations to them, right? Like, we know why they did what they did, and we ascribe that to them. Well, why not, since we're guessing anyway, why don't we give people the benefit of the doubt and just assume that it was positive, that it wasn't all those negative things that we have done? Assume the best and not the worst, okay? Think the best over your team. Last, have fun with teens, okay? They are a great group. They have so much life, so much energy. They've got lots of great questions. It is such a fun and amazing time in a student's life to be connected and to be a part with them. And don't miss out on that. Sure, it's scary. Sure, there's a lot of change and upheaval. But just like David said, your works are wonderful. I know that full well. God's work is wonderful in our teens and our students. What he is doing in them and through them is amazing. And we get to partner with them. We get to walk with them. We get to be shepherds with them through this phase of life. Man, God bless you and thank you for your time.